Welcome to the For the Reef podcast. Each week we bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room. We try to bridge the gap between the saltwater aquarium hobby and coral reef conservation. Now, here are your hosts, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, Mitch Dender, with local fish store owner and first responder, Ian Bell.
Welcome back to another episode of the For the Reef podcast. Tonight, we're really excited. We have Jenna and Colin here from the Invasive Species Center. Hello and welcome, Jenna and Colin.
Thanks for having us, Mitch.
So the Invasive Species Center is a center that was established in 2011. It's a registered nonprofit. I think you guys are based out of Sault Ste. Marie, right?
That's right. Yep.
Got it. Yeah. Today's actually the birthday of the Invasive Species Center, funny enough. So we didn't bring a cake, but today's 11 years. So there we go.
Nice. Well, happy birthday to the center. The Invasive Species Center is a hub for collaboration and knowledge sharing. The center is a respected partner and leader in invasive species science, education, and action. I was reading a little bit out of you guys' annual letter, and I noticed you had your vision statement and your mission, which is kind of cool. So I'll read them anyway. The mission of the center is to connect stakeholders, knowledge, and technology to prevent the spread of invasive species that threaten our environment, economy, and society. And their vision is a Canada where land and water are protected from invasive species. So pretty cool. And I think it molds nicely with our podcast.
Yeah, it's, you know, the maybe the more layman's version, I think, of what the center is and what's its function is it's a connection point, I guess, maybe a hub between a lot of people who are working on invasive species and maybe they don't really understand how far reaching some of the impacts are. You know, we have a lot of staff that are working for municipalities that are finding a tough time dealing with invasive species like emerald ash borer. And then we have researchers and academics, and we have friends of groups, and we have hobbyists and everybody in between, right? So it's, I think the center's doing its job if there's a way, it's a mechanism for those people to communicate, just share grievances, share resources, share best practices, and get together around this issue that kind of knows no boundaries.
Yeah. And so what would you guys' role be in the Invasive Species Center, and how long have you guys been part of that mission?
I'll go first, Jen, and then I'll throw it over to you. So I've been with the center for about 5 years, and I'm the policy manager there. So I work with our provincial government and federal governments and other partners just to try and make sure that we're doing the best we can on our invasive species policy, and maybe making small changes and tweaks to kind of regulations or little things that we're doing to ask of people, whether it's to kind of clean your boat when you're pulling it out of one boat launch and moving over to another lake, or we're thinking about what species can reasonably kind of be bought and sold, and everything in between.
Nice. How about you, Jenna?
Yeah, so I'm the policy and program development intern with the ISC. So this is only my, I guess, eighth month or so with ISC. So I'm still pretty new, but I work primarily with the invasive carp program. And before ISC, I obtained my master's in environmental studies and a degree in political science. So invasive species are close to my heart though too, and happy to kind of be in a program that supports environmental work like this. So it's been really great so far.
Amazing. Yeah, I think like some of the main invasive species, and of course this is the For the Reef podcast, so we talk a lot about the aquatic species. We also talk a lot about the aquarium hobby and aquarium hobbyists. I guess the aquarium industry is a potential vector for invasive species. So how have you guys, as you've been kind of already told me, the Invasive Species Center is starting to look at the potential for invasive species to come from the aquatic hobby, the fish tank industry, the aquarium industry?
Yeah, we work a lot in pathways, right? Because focusing on any one species is tough. There's a lot of invasive species out there. So we work a lot on these kind of pathways. And It's very much come on our radar the last couple of years, especially. We've had a few great occurrences of maybe opportunities to improve a little bit more. So we've been working on this pathway approach, and really this kind of hobbyist community has come on our radar as a great group, a great opportunity for us to check in with and just talk about, you know, from our perspective, you know, what are these invasive species? How do they move about and how do they get released into the natural environment? And it's kind of interesting. I think the more we dig into it, the more we kind of realize that I think from an invasive species perspective, we've done a lot of our work focusing on maybe the angler's perspective or other kind of outdoor enthusiasts from their perspective once we see these things established in our natural areas and in our lakes and waterways. And we've had a couple good occurrences. Maybe we'll dig into a little bit later. Just one that pops out recently is the mothball experience we had in 2021. And it was a great opportunity that we learned that working with some of our partners, whether it's retailers, whether it's people on the other side of the point of sale, you know, enthusiasts, any kind of recreational user, that this is a great chance for us to connect with these groups and just try and, you know, have a shared conversation around what can we do, you know, what can we encourage some of our other users to not do, things like releasing species from the aquariums for a variety of reasons, but primarily from our perspective, because they have a great chance of becoming invasive. So, we're happy just to have the conversation, and we've been having it more and more lately, especially, it's Invasive Species Awareness Week, this week, kind of late February and into early March this year. So it's a conversation we've been having a lot lately, and it's kind of an important topic for us. So we're happy to check in with you.
Yeah. And I mean, you said the moss ball, which Ian probably doesn't recognize the moss ball as much as he's a saltwater guy, but in the freshwater world, there's moss balls that you can buy as a plant, and they're great for sucking out nitrates from your aquarium. They're a good biological boost that people put into an aquarium. Shrimp and all kinds of fish love them. And obviously they're a potential pathway for invasive species. So what would the main invasive species be that you'd be worried about with a moss ball?
Yeah, so it's a great example of kind of a case in point. There's a few other examples, but with the moss ball story, so essentially the quick version of the story is last year we came to the recognition that there were zebra mussel veligers contained within some moss balls that were being commercially sold in Canada. Wow. And pretty widely distributed to across many provinces. And so once we kind of came to that realization, of course, we go into rapid response mode and try and work with our industry partners to figure out, you know, what is the best way to contain this threat? Because zebra mussels, you know, of course, people are going there not to the store, not obviously wanting to purchase zebra mussels. It's just kind of something that's snuck in. And so when they bring their moss balls home, of course, great practice. And Mitch, you outline all the reasons why they're wonderful product. The challenge being is that we know, you know, some folks who bring some things home, not just moss balls, but many examples, maybe especially people who might be newer to the hobby, might look at an opportunity when their relationship perhaps with their pet or with their hobby ends. We look at not responsible disposal practices, or, you know, that's kind of code for going out to the stormwater pond behind the subdivision and letting the tank fly, right? And of course, we recognize that's the minority. That's certainly not the majority of users. Of course, the vast majority are responsible users, but it just takes one introduction to cause that start of a new population. And with zebra mussels being just such a priority species for us to keep out of freshwaters across Canada, across North America, you know, we see individual provinces literally spending millions of dollars every year to try and find mitigation techniques, whether it's boat inspection stations or other techniques. We see a lot of investment going into trying to stop the spread of zebra mussels. And so this was a good case in point that came up last year, Mitch, just for us to come to the realization that there's other pathways that maybe haven't been addressed. And so, you know, these villagers sneaking in on moss balls was just kind of, I don't know if it's a Trojan horse, but just kind of maybe the understood or under-respected pathway. So
yeah, that's really
a great response there.
For sure. And that, like, that's not even what I was thinking. I wouldn't even have thought, even from, like, I've seen zebra mussels all over everything out in our, you know, the river that we have here, the Detroit River, and everywhere else you find zebra mussels. And I wouldn't even have thought that a moss ball, I mean, it makes complete sense. And I think that brings up another big question. So I work in fisheries, and I've gotten lots of, you know, talk with people, fishermen of all sorts, and, you know, different just people around the public. And they would say, oh, well, zebra mussels are amazing. They cleaned up the river, you know? So that brings up that big question of what makes something non-native and what makes something invasive?
It's an excellent question. I think we look at a lot of really obvious invasive species. They get a lot of notoriety and say, of course they're invasive. You know, they do bad things. They have negative consequences and impacts, and therefore they're just because they're invasive. But I think, you know, your question is excellent, because I think it's important for us to focus in on maybe a more technical definition. And it's really easy to work with. Is it a species that's expanded its historic range? So this is the first box you need to check to become invasive. So are you, you know, expanding your geography? And usually we're talking about a continental scale. So, you know, if we have a species that's not historically from the area we're talking about, zebra mussels, case in point, native to Eurasia. So coming here, you have to check one of three other boxes. So do you have negative consequences on the ecology or environment of the area you're becoming invasive within? If so, there you go. You've classified as an invasive species. Do you have negative consequences on the more social lenses of things? So maybe that's how we recreate, how we use our waterways. So if you're walking into that same lake and you now have to wear water shoes, or you can't walk into that same water body because it's choked out in aquatic plants that are non-native or invasive, there you go. You've checked the second box. And the third box is economic impacts. And so we look at, you know, a variety of species. Like I just said, there are zebra mussel prevention programs costing us, you know, a couple million dollars per province, depending on where we are within Canada and what province we're talking about. And of course, those are programs that exist because they're economically viable and important. And the impacts, should zebra mussels establish in those provinces, far outweigh those couple million dollars. We did a great survey last year of Ontario municipalities just to understand what are their species priorities. And we found that emerald ash borer was causing more than $26 million per year for Ontario municipalities just to manage. So just to cut down native ash trees under the threat of this invasive forest pest. So if you check one of those three boxes at the end there, economic impacts, environmental impacts, or social or recreational impacts, usually we'd consider that a good example of an invasive species.
Yeah, that makes sense. The you know, there's so many species out there. I mean, at least with the aquarium industry, you know, first one that I just thought of when it comes to invasive species is the pleco, which isn't from here, but it's it doesn't establish itself here. But if you look at videos from Florida, the plectominis or whatever they're called, they're like the algae eating sucker fish. They get really big, and then people don't want them anymore. So they release them into the rivers and stuff around Florida. You can see videos of just like completely covering the floors or the stream beds of, these Florida streams are completely covered with, of the plecos. I guess another one here is the red-eared slider, which is a turtle. I know a lot of people release those as a pet. Is a red-eared slider, is that considered an invasive species in Ontario?
Yeah, it's another good example. It's a really familiar species, right? Everybody's familiar with. If you keep a turtle at home and it's not native, in Ontario at least, chances are very good that it is that red-eared slider species. And, you know, they're fairly common when we go to those kind of urban ponds, urban waterways, stormwater ponds. If we'd go out there and we see a turtle sunning on a log, it would be a good example. Yeah, perfect. Exactly what we would expect to see. So any turtle that you go out and see in the environment that has that little red fleck above its eye or kind of past where if turtle had an ear, that's where it would be. That would be a red-eared slider. And, you know, the challenge with them is that, of course, they're kind of out competing native species for those same niches, those same kind of environment types, right, that we'd expect to see other native turtles, maybe a painted turtle, which is a native turtle. We have 8 native turtles in Ontario. So, you know, any number of those probably would be able to occupy that habitat. I mean, the other kicker with invasive species broadly, red-eared slider being a good example, is they can move diseases around. So, you know, just from a disease containment perspective, rhinovirus is a great example of something that impacts reptiles. And sometimes native turtles too, but non-native turtles in particular can be carriers of rhinovirus. So you know, that has really negative consequences for some of our native species at risk that might be using that, salamanders or other amphibians that might be calling that pond home. And of course, you know, when the time comes, if somebody was ending their relationship with their red-eared slider, you know, spot the turtle and they wanted to go release it, there's just that chance that it's not just the turtle itself that's being released, which could have its own negative consequences, but there's also that unknown factor. It's kind of a similar theme, right, to the moss ball example with villagers being sneaky and attached.
Yeah. And I mean, now at least every single one of our turtles, I think, is now having some type of consideration for protection. I know the painted turtles and the northern map turtles, they both, to me, like, I'm not a turtle guy. and like, to those, to me, I mean, at first glance, that those turtles look just like a red-eared slider to me, even though, like, obviously they're a lot different. And there's a lot of cues to tell the difference. But it's, you know, sometimes you look out into these streams and stuff and into the stormwater ponds and people are like, oh, look at all the turtles, it's beautiful. And really they're all invasive species. Yeah, stormwater ponds seem to be like a big, a place where you'll always find invasive species. And the one I know for sure definitely comes from the aquarium hobby, and I've seen them by the millions in stormwater ponds is goldfish. So that's kind of a surprise to a lot of people that goldfish are now becoming like this massive problem.
It's true. It's another one that's, I think maybe the last couple of years, Mitch, especially, it's come on the radar a little bit more. We've got some good examples for maybe some Ontario listeners, Hamilton Harbor being a great spot if you want to go check out some goldfish.
Yeah.
Over in Coots Bay or Coots Paradise, there's lots there. So that's a great example there. And of course this is more maybe your area of expertise than mine, but goldfish in particular can regulate their size to, I mean, hey, speaking of turtles, there's another example, but they can regulate their size based on the confines of their environment, right? So that's why when we go out and see these things in the natural environment, if we're looking in Ontario or maybe some prairie waterways and we found some goldfish, chances are they're pretty big, maybe not this big, but pretty big.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's kind of the similar story, I think, to a lot of these other, there's a bit of a common theme coming here, maybe about, you know, what happens when you get to the end of that relationship and, you know, just making maybe the poor choice perhaps of releasing into the natural environment and some of the consequences that come along with it. Like, that's obviously a very healthy fish. It's outcompeted native species quite handily, of course, being that size. And, you know, there's a couple other good examples of just some of the negative consequences. They can also be carriers for disease as well, species like goldfish. So, you know, I think a lot of those releases, when they're coming intentionally like that, maybe they come from the best place in people's heart, of course. Like, I wouldn't challenge their motivations. I know they're perhaps in many cases very attached to the pet, but I think that picture kind of says 1,000 words in terms of maybe what some of those negative consequences can be for the other species that call that pond home, right? So some great, great goldfish pictures there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the goldfish, so I do a fair amount of impact studies and ecological surveys of like aquatic environments. And we do a lot of drainage work, culverts and that sort of thing. So I find it's and I know this is the wrong term to use. You know, a lot of people say like they throw around the ecosystem engineers type of thing, which I wouldn't call goldfish that, but in what I always find is when I find big populations of goldfish in like a native stream, it's usually they're found in areas where like typically you'll find a lot of sunfish, gizzard shads, and even shrimps and things like that. But what happens, I notice when they get established is, I don't know if I know they're pretty aggressive in the way that they consume the vegetation on the stream bed bottom. They stir up a lot of turbidity. And I think that kind of sucks the oxygen out of the water. And I really noticed it's kind of gross. Like in the areas where you'll find goldfish, there's just like massive amounts of hookworms on the fish. So like parasitic hookworms. If anybody, you know, of our listeners have seen these things before, they're like, I don't know, the name's kind of explanatory there. It's just kind of like a worm that hooks into the side of the fish, parasitic, similar to like an ick that you'd find in an aquarium. the more that there are, the harder it is for the fish to combat them. The more lesions on the fish can lead to disease of other types of disease. And the other one I noticed is called lymphocytosis, I think it's called. They're like big, nasty hemorrhages that happen on the side of the fish when water quality goes down. So these goldfish, they, you know, swim into these little happy habitats. They destroy all the vegetation. They suck the oxygen out of the water because of all of that decay. All of a sudden, disease and parasites are proliferating. And it kind of it really wipes out those native species that were there doing well. Because I think that goldfish actually, they can live in really low oxygen environments. I remember reading this thing, and I don't know if you guys can correct me if you know about this one, but there's something with the lung, the swim bladder, and the way that the goldfish can kind of pull from those oxygen reserves. I think it's like similar to a sturgeon and that sort of thing. So they can really live in low oxygen environments. So they just get in there and they turn these little environments into a living hell for the sunfish. And then they're happy as can be because it doesn't bother them as much. So yeah, I've really seen the spread of goldfish, and it's definitely a real big problem. So, which kind of mends into this question, because, you know, Ian has a young son, right? If Ian, if you had a goldfish and that goldfish is living for, you know, lives its life out in the house, and now nobody wants to take care of it and it's time for that fish to go bye-bye. You know, how hard would that conversation really be, like, to have, you know, with your kids about what are we going to do with this goldfish now?
That it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, you're probably the wrong person to ask this. But
yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I think, like, I've seen it happen with a lot of people where they get a goldfish, or they get an animal in general. I've seen it with other animals too. Cats is one. Where people they grow connected to these pets, and then they don't want to let them die or anything like that. So what would you recommend to people who no longer want their pet, like a fish or a turtle, you know, but they want to get rid of it?
Yeah, it's tricky, right? And like, I think Jenna and I both try and be pragmatic, and Jenna probably has a better answer to this than I do, but I think you raise a good point, Mitch, to Ian there about just there's maybe a point in this continuum of the lifespan of your relationship with that pet. And there's an important conversation to be had maybe about before you acquire the pet, about realistically, what's the responsibility here? What is the commitment? What's the term? Of course, there's a financial element for sure, too. So I think for people to go into, hopefully with the blinders off, that's, you know, that's really an important element, and try and be pragmatic, try and be realistic. And so, you know, I think that's probably the first is the prevention method. Now, I understand, you know, I may be one perhaps to be carried away and jump into something now and then too. So I understand, like, sometimes we find ourselves in difficult situations, and, you know, Jenna's got some good advice. So I'll maybe turn over to her, but just in terms of some of those steps, should you find yourself in the sticky situation of having the pet that maybe it might be a tough relationship. And when it comes there, Jenna, what do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that education piece is a really critical starting point. Like, I agree that, like, having the knowledge of how long your pet is going to live is probably pretty key in this whole process. Especially, you know, as you mentioned, goldfish can live a long time, and people aren't usually aware of that when they first acquire them. But yeah, if you do find yourself in a position where, you know, you can't keep your pet for whatever reason, we do kind of suggest that, you know, you consider rehoming it to potentially somebody else who's already a fish owner, or, you know, there are a lot of social media platforms where you can kind of network with people who might have the opportunity to care for your pet. Alternatively, we do suggest kind of school groups or other educational groups that may be willing to take it. Of course, returning it to the pet store, not always the best option, but a potential just in terms of trying to keep them out of the waterways is really key. And unfortunately, like, our last kind of note on that is to humanely, you know, dispose of it is another kind of very, very last resort. And this, of course, done with the aid of professionals. So again, not the best option, but something that, you know, would save an ecosystem in the future, because, you know, it isn't a matter of having an individual versus, you know, an entire community of fish or ecology that could be impacted. So, yeah.
I run into this.
I was actually going to say, Ian, you own a fish store. So what's your policy?
Yeah, I run into this all the time. And it's not always that the person has lost interest in the pet. Sometimes people have to move. Sometimes there's health problems. Recently, I had somebody whose husband was into the hobby, but he passed away and she had to know how to take care of it. Quite often, I'll take them in as long as they're with, you know, I take a good look at them first before I go putting them in my tanks and whatnot, because I don't know where they've come from. But generally, they're okay. Sometimes I can find new homes for them. A lot of times I'll take them to some of my clients, like nursing homes and stuff like that, that don't have big budgets for their fish tanks. So we'll take them there. Sometimes they live, if they're kind of a jerk, they live in my coral tanks. There's kind of fish jail. There's several that have been in there for years. I don't like to see anything, for lack of a better term, get flushed. So sometimes I'll take in stuff that I know I can't really do a lot with, but I just make the choice to do that. And I think as long as you're not trying to take an animal somewhere that's visibly unhealthy, a lot of pet stores are probably, at least the smaller private owned ones, are probably willing to help you, because I think we're a little bit more in touch with the animals than say a big box store would be. But I think it comes down to an education piece. And I think it's slowly starting to happen. People are starting to realize that it's not a commodity. It's an animal. It's a life. It's a pet. You have to, and we, I try and educate people that in the store, you know, you've taken on the responsibility for this creature. Now it's your job to take care of it. I would hope you wouldn't just discard your kid on the side of the street because he made you mad one day. Like, you've got to keep this up long term. And I think that's just part of the conversation when people come in, especially new folks, when they come in all the time. I'm very straight up with them. I'm like, I'm going to tell you what's going to work, what's not going to work. And if I think you can't have it in your aquarium, I'm not going to sell it to you. But that's a personal choice that I make as a business. And, you know, there probably needs to be a little bit more of that.
Right. Yeah. The one thing that you mentioned that I think's great to bring up. One, I won't dive into how to humanely euthanize a fish on this podcast, but if anyone is curious, I'm happy to provide some advice that comes from the Department of Fisheries on how to humanely euthanize fish. We have to do it, you know, at work. Occasionally, I'll have to do that under different permits. Let's say we're cleaning a stormwater pond and it's filled with invasive species. They may ask us to euthanize the fish that we find. There are humane ways to do it, ways that you can do at home without any special equipment or anything like that. You mentioned one thing that is really, really common in the aquarium industry, and that's fishing them. Whether they're live or dead. Sometimes people will flush them live thinking, oh, this, my fish is just gonna keep living in this sewer system. No, they die a long, painful death in the sewers before they eventually, you know, give up. And the other part of that is even if you're flushing a dead, you know, fish down your drain, you're potentially spreading disease. So I would recommend that no one does do that and flush them. I think, is that the stance that you guys have from the center?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very much actually. Yeah. So, you know, back to that idea of what else is in there that you may not be thinking of, whether it's disease or again, back to the veliger in the moss ball example, there's a whole lot of unknown. People going into the, you know, maybe with full knowledge that the fish has been floating belly up for a while, maybe it's safe to go and pitch it. And I know that was kind of course, the common practice in years before, maybe. But yeah, very much not a best practice. So alive or dead, it's that, you know, that's if there's people taking away one message and they could share the word on that, I think that's a win for us today.
Yeah. So what I do with any fish that I have is just I usually freeze them. So I go fishing a lot. So this is pretty standard stuff. When you go fishing and you fillet the fish and then you have the leftovers, I'll just put them in a bag, put them in the freezer, let them freeze so that it doesn't stink. And then I just put them out the night before for in the garbage. That would be how I would do it, is freezing them and getting rid of them. That's what I would do with pets too that pass away. Do you guys agree with that way of doing it?
Yeah, it's definitely the best, most practical. Again, we're trying to be pragmatic for folks too, right? With that kind of advice, I think that's a really good step-by-step way to go. It's definitely what I do personally as well. So that is our best practice. It seems to be the best way to mitigate unknown risk of what would happen should you release that live or dead into an aquatic system. So yeah. Freezer, get rid of the smell. That's a great piece of advice. And then pitch out the night before through the garbage. It's a great practice.
It kind of reminds me of the last podcast. My wife and I did a podcast talking about what it's like to live with a fish guy. And it just reminded me, like, if you, back in the day, so I haven't done this in a while, but, you know, I've definitely flushed a few fish over my years, you know. I've been in the aquarium in this, like, hobby my entire life. You know, you don't want to flush a fish and it be too big and not go down the drain. And then the next time your wife goes to use the washroom, a fish pops up. So it's always good. If you want to live a happy life. I guess that also applies to, like, next one I should do is have my mom come onto this podcast and stories. But yeah, that's a big one. So do not flush your fish, your pets. It's a no-no. What type of management techniques right now are you seeing out there in the field and controlling invasive, aquatic invasive species?
It's pretty wide ranging. I think, you know, most of the action, I think, in terms of controlling invasive species, aquatic invasive species in Ontario and probably Canada wide would be in nuisance vegetation control. So aquatic plants, which definitely can have an aquarium linkage in. You know, there's a number of aquatic plants that have been released, sometimes intentionally, actually. I've got too much of that water soldier in my pond, so I'll throw it into the closest lake. You know, again, probably coming from a good place in people's heart, but maybe not so good in terms of the environment, devastating ecological impacts and notable, yeah, flowering rush, another great example. So there's lots of aquatic plants out there, and they get a lot of the management effort. Usually what does management look like for aquatic plants tends to be herbicide based. Sometimes it's physical control. Maybe it's mowing, maybe it's digging plants out, but we're talking about scale. If we're talking about, you know, hectares or acres and acres, which can happen, unfortunately, of aquatic plants, then usually that means some sort of herbicide application, which of course can have, there's proper great steps being taken, of course, to mitigate other negative consequences of that, but to be realistic here, of course, there can always have the opportunity to have negative consequences with that. So it is a challenging situation, but in many cases, that's the right move to make. To flip over away from plants into maybe fish, there's a range of management techniques. It kind of depends on the system, right? Like if we're talking about a stormwater management pond, you know, maybe you have controls over that and you can do a drawdown like you were talking about before, and maybe look at just kind of more selective removal of the species. Sometimes if the conditions are right, like we've seen, you know, there's a great example from Western Canada and Alberta last year about rotenone being used in a pond. And effectively, that's just a herbicide that it's got some significant consequences. It knocks out, you know, virtually all fish that are within that pond. So it really is kind of a, you know, I wouldn't call it like maybe a reset button would be too colloquial, but I think it's a good idea, I guess, or good way of explaining what rotenone can do to a pond. And so that could wipe out all fish within a system and really enables you then to go back and maybe restock more desirable species. So we don't see that being used every time a goldfish is found. Of course, that doesn't mean rotenone comes out, but there are a number of case studies we've seen in the last couple of years in Canada where it's used. And of course, usually there's another motivating factor behind it. It's not just about getting rid of the goldfish or whatever the nuisance species might be. Maybe that's home to species at risk habitat. cutthroat trout being a good example that we've seen before happen. So it really kind of depends on how, not heavy-handed you want to be, but how, you know, how severe the management intervention would be. Just kind of depends on, you know, why are you doing it? What are the assets you're trying to protect or restore? And so it kind of looks a little different depending on where you are and what you're doing. So that's it in terms of management. There's some cool monitoring approaches that are being done too that are kind of equally as neat and interesting. There's environmental DNA, which is being done, people going out sampling, just looking for the smallest flakes of skin or excrement, just kind of the smallest little signature of that species you're looking for was there. And you can just process a little water sample and find it, or you can use electrofishing if you're going out looking for some of these species you might know too. So there's an awful lot of ways you can go out to find the species. Once you've got them there, it really just depends on what is the system you're managing and what are your techniques that are available to you.
Yeah, actually, on the eDNA thing, I was watching this presentation of this student giving his presentation about eDNA and using it to identify, I forget what the species was, but yeah, basically you can take a scoop of water out of a you know, watershed and be able to kind of say what's there. In some cases, you can be pretty specific. I don't expect you guys to be able to answer this question, but I thought it was the coolest question because it was just so different. Because you get into these, you know, you go see these presentations and it's on eDNA in a research center. Every question is about the science and all of that. But there was like a policy maker who was in the room. So he raises his question, he raises his hand and he goes, well, so with eDNA, is it worse to have, because one of the problems with eDNA is the degradation time. And sometimes you can get false positives and sometimes you can get false negatives in your sample. And he said, well, what's worse? Is it better? Is it worse to get a false negative or is it worse to get a false positive? I.e., is it better to spend all of this money to prevent a species that isn't actually there because you don't have the species, you just have the environment, you just have the DNA of the species? Or is it better to get ahead of it and start spending the money and then maybe you prevent it from being there if the case of a false negative? Anyway, it was just kind of like this question that's always stuck in my mind about invasive species, because it is like there is this whole philosophical discussion that you can have with invasive species that I really like, you know, of how do we describe, you know, what makes up proper ecology and how are native species, which native species do we reintroduce into an area? You know, certain species, you bring them back into, like, an example being you have a native species that historically and hundreds of years ago, we have some data that shows that there was a species in this area that used to exist and it has some economic value. So we're going to bring it back because that was a species that was there, but we don't bring back a species that potentially doesn't have, you know, these obvious economic values, but they might have these ecological values. It's kind of just something. I wonder if you guys have had any kind of discussion about how you allocate your resources and how you focus on, because I mean, there's got to be a limit to how much money you guys can spend on different species and stuff. How do you guys kind of gauge, let's spend a lot of money on control of this or that, or, you know, how does that kind of play out for you guys?
It's the question we all wrestle with almost every day is there's limited resources here. Invasive species is a very big issue. It has reach into, you know, into how we grow our food, into like how we manage our forests, into how we manage our waterfront property values and everything in between. And so, you know, we know it's a fixed pot of resources that we can use, and we really only have the chance to kind of, where can we make the biggest impact, get the best bang for our buck? And quite clearly, it's very clearly on the prevention side. So money is very well spent trying to prevent new invasive species from coming, being introduced, from first establishing. So back to your eDNA idea, I think if we were out there sampling for those priority species that maybe are not established in Canada or in our province of choice. So if it's a Western Canada perspective or the prairie region, and they're you know, putting their limited chips into preventing zebra mussels or quagga mussels coming from, you know, for instance, Ontario or Quebec or Eastern Canada and migrating west, that's money really well spent, even if you do pick up a false positive now and then, just because that's when your opportunity to strike is from a management perspective and really have a cost-effective win. But once species become well-established, you know, generally speaking, there might be some examples where this isn't truly the case, but generally speaking, the cost of trying to manage those and fight those back is often cost prohibitive. So once these species become established, there is this kind of critical point where, yeah, it might be invasive and it might have those negative consequences, but it's just not a battle we can afford to engage with. So there is kind of, you know, a tough, challenging question that we have to kick around often about how do we allocate limited resources? And usually it goes very early in that kind of stage of invasion. So if we think about something from its kind of time establishment, a new species being introduced, you know, zebra mussels maybe 25 or 30 years ago, right as it was very early in its introduction stage, that would really be the opportunity in the Great Lakes region to really have an effective heavy response on. Whereas once it becomes established and it's in every tributary and every lake and watershed and really kind of established itself, it's really hard to justify the management costs of going back. Now, it's not to say that species isn't costly. You know, if you're a municipal water treatment staff and you're focused on keeping your pipe clear so it can intake water from whatever your water body is so you can treat that water and have that be available, you might be changing out those pipes way more often than you'd like to, just because zebra mussels can kind of jump on and start to form inner circles and clog up those pipes, right? So it's very costly, and those established species can be very expensive. But really, from our perspective, I think if we're thinking about how can we have the best bang for our buck, it has to be on preventing those species from establishing, or right when we first pick them up, when that first eDNA hit or that first few eDNA hits turn up positive on a new species, that's the time to strike. And the time to strike with heavy resource investment where we can for the right species is really a good move. So in terms of species we're looking for, species that would fit that bill right now in this moment in the Great Lakes and in Canada more broadly would be Asian carp. And Jen is the Asian carp expert here, so maybe I'll turn it over to her to maybe talk about, you know, the threats that are posed by Asian carp or all species of them. And let us know maybe, Jenna, what you think in terms of what are the options on the table and why is the moment now?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are four species of carp that we're kind of concerned with. It's grass, black, silver, and bighead carp. Grass carp are the most immediate threat to the Great Lakes. So as Colin mentioned, you know, we're in the preventative stage right now of having these carp being kind of close to the border. They're not fully established in Canada yet, but there have been 39 captures of grass carp in Canada. So we are we're right on the edge of a potential invasion. And so we really have to be mindful of, you know, monitoring for these species and making sure that they aren't, you know, coming into Canada and establishing, because all of the Great Lakes are suitable habitats for them. So basically, the grass carp in particular, eat so much food, vegetation in particular, they can eat up to 40% of their body weight in a single day, which can cause a lot of issues because, you know, with the excrement, they end up kind of affecting water quality in a negative manner. And I should just clarify too, those are Prussian carp on the screen, but same family. making sure that they don't establish in Canada is really key. And so like Colin mentioned, there are preventative kind of measures in place, including, physical barriers, monitoring like electrofishing, DFO, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, are really responsible for a lot of the monitoring that takes place during the summer months to make sure that they aren't coming into the Great Lakes. And that's a little bit of a quick rundown of the CART program. But as Colin mentioned, prevention, early response is key.
And so how are they getting in?
So yeah, it's interesting. There are tributaries to the Great Lakes that connect, and essentially there are already grass carp in Lake Erie on the American side. And so this is, you know, obviously a pathway for them. But the Mississippi River Basin is kind of an area for this. But yeah, they're accessing the Great Lakes from the United States. Yeah.
So kind of through like the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that, there's like an electric fence or something, isn't there?
That's right. Yes. So it's interesting. There is that the barrier, the physical barrier that exists. But it's interesting because sometimes, and we've seen this before in some of our outreach and what we're working on, but bait fish can be actually confused for juvenile carp. And this can cause an issue if people are dumping their bait. So this is another pathway that if they, you know, aren't coming through that barrier, but if they're released as bait fish, this could be obviously a pathway of introduction as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And which one of the Asian carp is the one that people see on YouTube all the time of it jumping out of the water? And
that's the silver carp. Yeah. Yeah. So they are often disturbed by boat motors or movement in the water. And so that causes them to jump up to 3 meters out of the water. So
yeah,
definitely a concern if you're, you know, just driving through a waterway in your boat and you've got carp jumping at you, they definitely pack a punch. So
yeah. And I guess on that monitoring side, I noticed that you guys have a report a sighting link on the website. Do you want to kind of describe why that's there and how people should use it?
Yeah, it's true, right? Like I think we of course we don't expect everyone to be an expert on every invasive species. Jenna and I certainly are not, that's for sure. So the species that you know, that you come across in the natural environment that are invasive, there's great opportunities for engagement for any of us just to report a species. There's a few great kind of mechanisms you can report, and you know, the onus is on us to find those invasive species reports. So if you're familiar with iNaturalist, you know, many birders and many naturalist types are. It's a great app. It's a great website that you can submit a report of any species. So that's a good one, but there's other ones too. And they kind of range across Canada in terms of what are the preferred ones. A really great one that we love to promote is EDMAPS, EDDMAPS. And it's another platform, very similar. It's a smartphone app for any smartphone. It's a website as well. The good benefit of EDMAPS is any report comes in to EDMAPS is verified by an expert. So there's somebody on the other end here. So if I submitted my picture of Sasquatch and said, I think this is an Asian carp, you know, there's somebody there to kind of verify that, you know, not quite, that wasn't quite it. And if you're a little bit unsure too about your ID, of course, if you can throw something in as a mystery plant and have somebody help you out in terms of figuring out what it is. So whether it's, you know, buckthorn, a common woody shrub that's invasive, or, oh, there we go. Yeah, EDMAPS. So it's a really good tool. If you're interested in looking up where can I find a species, you know, maybe there's somebody interested in finding giant hogweed, which is a good example of a species that we see in June and July, a lot of news articles about. The sap can come on people's skin and kind of cause really nasty burns. So, you know, I've heard a few people say, I'm interested, you know, I really want to see what that plant looks like. This would be good because you can pull up a distribution map of a species like a giant hogweed and find out where it is and maybe go looking for it if that's your jam, or if you want to stay away from it, you could also, you know, use that as a tool there too. So,
and I guess on that one too, we had we usually put out you know, an ask for questions from our listeners, and we had a question that I think plays in nicely to this kind of idea of, you know, the role of the public in reporting and what they're supposed to do when they find invasive species. So this one actually has to do with the round goby. Round goby is a really prolific invasive species now in the Great Lakes, and down in our area, they're really abundant in the Detroit River. People catch them occasionally when they're fishing. So Jake Hall asked, "Are fishermen supposed to kill invasive species like the round goby?"
There's a number of different regulations that come into play with something like an Asian carp. Of course, this is a priority species, round goby being another good example of a species that there are regulations. There are federal regulations that pertain to certain species. There are provincial regulations too. So it kind of depends on where you are and who might have authority. I think a really good practice, if you see something like a round goby or, of course, an Asian carp, that's definitely like a priority species that I would not want to be releasing back into the water body. So the best advice we can give, of course, there's kind of federal and provincial regulations that come into play. And for many of those species that are priority aquatic invasive species, absolutely, please do not put back into the water. You know, for those species that you might find the only grass carp or one of the very few grass carp, of course, that would have a really negative consequence if you put that back into the water body. For a widely established species like a zebra mussel, if we picked out a rock and found one, or maybe we caught, some other well-established species, you know, of course, putting it back in is not a very good practice. It's not going to have the same negative consequences, of course, that releasing a priority species back into the water body would have. But still, you know, rule of thumb from my perspective is if it's an invasive species, not a good idea to release it back into the water body you found it in.
Yeah, fair enough. And that kind of another question that always kind of springs in my head, round goby is definitely one of them. I know, and the reason why I think this, I guess, is over time, it seems like these invasive species, they have this really abrupt and there's a really dramatic impact when they first establish themselves in a new area. And then over time, there seems to be a bit of not a transition per se. I know that there's lots of impact still, but getting to the point here, we have, so like with a round goby, right? It's like a little spineless morsel of fish. You know, a lot of fish now prey on them. You can find them in the guts of sturgeon or in the stomach of sturgeon. You can find them in the stomachs of bass. Story that, I can't pull up the paper right off my top of my head, but I believe that the freshwater eel, its recovery was attributed a bit to feeding on round gobies. Of course, gobies still have a really bad impact on, spawning fish, and they compete with darters and other things like that. But how do you see, do you guys ever look at kind of how invasive species start to kind of blend in with a natural ecology?
It's a good one. It's a tough question. That idea of naturalization, when does a species become naturalized, is a toughie, to be quite transparent and honest about it. I would say, you know, there's many, usually we're talking about larger scales of time, I think, than your, my lifetime when a species came in. If we were young and, you know, when we leave this earth, that's probably not long enough to meet that naturalization threshold. You know, something else I would kind of cite would be, you know, is it still having, you know, think back to those three boxes, right? Those negative consequences on the environment. It's not to say that a species that's not native, but not invasive, you know, so like a common garden plant that we might come across. Of course, the vast majority of those plants that we see in nurseries are not native, but they're not being released into the environment and having those devastating negative consequences. So it wouldn't meet that definition of invasive. But, you know, back to the example at hand with round goby, or maybe you cited a little bit earlier there about, if somebody was played devil's advocate on the zebra mussel thing. And, you know, they cleaned up the water, you know, turbidity. Yeah. And now all of a sudden, you know, the Kawartha lakes are wonderful, clean water bodies. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, maybe they had a little bit more aquatic plant growth in them. So,
yeah,
you know, I hear that it's a complicated conversation, I guess. And there's a lot of nuance to it. I guess, Mitch, my best response would be usually they're still having those negative consequences. I definitely would hear the point that there's probably a time that maybe we could see some of those invasive species become naturalized in a sense, but I think that's decades and decades and decades from now for most of the species we're pretty familiar with. Even species that have been here for, you know, 200 or 150 years are really starting to see other changes happen that can kind of release more opportunity for them environmentally. So, you know, dog strangling vine is a good example. It's a common kind of a vine plant that we'd see in terrestrial environments, and and, you know, either between climate change and maybe, you know, seasonality or other opportunities opening up for the species, we're seeing it move into new spaces. So I don't think it's maybe a clean story, I guess, that things find new opportunities, new niches, or new abilities to kind of maybe reestablish themselves in that invasive species definition or ground. So it's a tough one, but you know, I think you brought up earlier the idea of just bass, and this is a good example, right? Because we see, you know, especially in kind of northern Ontario into Manitoba, we see some lakes that maybe historically weren't established with something like smallmouth bass, but they're a great sport fish. And so people might, you know, choose to stock them, and they might say, well, it's native to Ontario, you know, in southern Ontario, it's of course is considered a native species. But it doesn't take much in terms of that range expansion to kind of find a new water body. And maybe that definition that we set up in terms of has it expanded its historical range, yeah. You know, maybe we're just not thinking about the environment in a evolving sense, that, you know, kind of what we're trying to restore towards or what we're considering as our reference point might be changing, right? You know, how far, you know, with permafrost and every other elements of climate change, like, how is our landscape changing? And maybe that should be factored into our definition of what's native or invasive.
Yeah, and I think you like really nailed it on the head for me when you said that, you know, when we look at things in the scope of time, nothing in ecology or in the environment is an easier way of explaining it. It's nothing in the environment happens quickly. That's good. A lot of these things take really, really long periods of time. And it's probably not a good way to look at things where we say, you know, well, they've been here for a long time. Well, in relation to, you know, ecological timelines or even evolutionary timelines, they haven't been here a long time. And, you know, when we look at through our human lens of how long something's been here versus, you know, how long does it really take to become part of the natural ecology? It's a timeline that I think it's hard for me included to even wrap your head around, that, you know, we can't really put a timeline on when things are going to start to become part of the natural ecology. I know one is the common carp that we find around here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think common carp were actually considered native, right?
Yep, you're correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And so people see them everywhere. And, you know, those ones, I guess it blurs that line between what's native and what's invasive. And, you know, and I don't know why this keeps popping into my head. There's something that happened recently that really blew my mind. It has nothing to do with aquatic invasive species, but I'll say it anyway, because I find it kind of interesting. It has to do with pets, at least. We had feral cats, and I won't get into the whole details. But there was a project. There were some feral cats that were on the project. Those were brought to a place where they were neutered or spayed, and then instead of those cats being, you know, tried to be like, feral cats are a whole different thing. It's really hard to train or to domesticate a feral cat once it's already lived most of its life out in the wild. But there's a really known impact of cats on songbird populations. And I was told from an agency that what we should do with the feral cats after they neutered them or spayed them was to bring them into a woodlot and let them go. And it was like, that's the advice that we're giving people. I mean, I think sometimes, and I'm not the most sensitive when it comes to people when they take on pets. I know you guys are really, you're really sensitive to why people decide to let go pets. But I think, like, once you become educated on the impacts of aquatic species or invasive species, I mean, that point, when you buy that pet, in my opinion, I think you have to also take on the responsibility of whether that you need to euthanize that pet or, you know, you need to make some hard decisions and deal with them yourself. So, you know, in this case with these cats and stuff, I'm sure people let go cats all the time that they no longer want to take care of. Another just good example of, you know, I hope out of this podcast, everyone who's listening, it's a very hard emotional decision on whether or not you should, you know, let go of your pets, but do not let your pets go. Find other solutions. If you ever need help, if you don't know what to do, you can use this podcast as a way. You guys can email us or reach out to us. And I would personally be happy to help anybody with their pets to find a home for them, or to advise them on what they should do with them. Cause I know it is a hard decision, but that cat story really just grind my gears a bit because, you know, I get it that it's a domesticated animal and we all fall in love with cats and dogs and things like that. But, we can't forget about all of the native species that are out there that may be put at risk because of our pets. That's my ramble. I'll step off the podium or whatever that saying is.
You're lucky I didn't have to push you off the soapbox.
Yeah, the soapbox, that's right.
Because I'm with you. And like to think back to Ian's comments earlier, I'm glad that there's people that have that, you know, that sensibility to just hopefully at the point of procurement, just to have that tough conversation and try and be realistic, right? That it is a termed commitment. And again, I think, you know, Jen and I are trying to be pragmatic about this generally too. So we understand, you know, sometimes you come into that, but Mitch, I think he raised a great point about it's worth consideration from an ethical perspective. If that's where your mindset is at, when you're coming to the emotional decision to end your relationship with the pet, just about, you know, that there are other impacts to the native species, to the natural environment, and that, you know, from an ethical perspective, you might get down in the weeds here, but there's something to be said in terms of thinking about the environment and the constituents or individuals within that environment too, not just about necessarily exclusively the well-being of the individual pet.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the other thing would just be, you know, is there anything, Ian comes from a really, you know, in-depth and diverse career in the, you know, aquarium industry. I've been a hobbyist forever. Do you guys keep aquariums? Do you have any questions or, you know, something that you would want to kind of address in the aquarium realm?
I don't keep an aquarium well, or not anymore. So I won't even go there.
Yeah.
But no, it's, you know, I think we've got some good feedback today. I think the last year or two, especially we've, you know, our perspective, I think from Jenna and my perspective, maybe coming at this from the Invasive Species Center lens is just how can we try and find like a reasonable approach in terms of engaging with your audience and folks within the hobby and just trying to find like understand their perspective a little bit more about when you're coming to that when you're coming to that challenging opportunity, like what is a reasonable course of action that might accomplish goals of both parties, I guess, or both perspectives or all perspectives. So, I appreciate the conversation and we've got some good feedback that we're able to take away. I think, Jenna, what do you think?
One thing that comes up all the time when I was mentioning before how sometimes people will bring in fish or you could see them trying to rehome them or various creatures. I think the mindset, if you've reached the point where you have to shut down your aquarium or disengage with your pet, you've reached the point where you have to let go of the perceived monetary value in your mind. It now becomes about the animal, not about selling it. And I have people come in all the time, like, I have to move in 3 days. Can you take these and what will you give me? It's not my problem. It's your problem. You're responsible for that animal. I'm providing you a way out. It doesn't become my financial responsibility to buy it, to bail you out of that. I'm willing to do it. But I think at that point, you have to start caring about the creature and let go of the monetary. This was your decision. You're getting out of it. I've given you an out, or the person that you found on Kijiji is giving you an out. Be thankful for that. Be thankful for the creature to have that and move on with your life.
Yeah, there's always that difference in the way that people treat their furry animals compared to their scaled animals. And you know, we're a couple of fish guys, so I think we have a more empathetic view for the fish that we keep. I have a name for pretty much every fish back here. so it's I completely agree. I mean, every animal, whether it lives underwater or above, has its own intrinsic value. And when we make decisions about, you know, deciding to keep a fish or to keep any type of aquatic pet, even if it's because in your mind, it's maybe you're doing it because you want to educate your children or whatever it is, just, you know, take a second and think about the long term and remember that kind of ethical responsibility to take care of that animal for as long as it's in your ownership. I think that's really, really key message from tonight. And I guess on that note as well, we have from a feedback note, you guys have a survey here. We have it scrolling across our screen. We're also going to send it out to all of our channels. We'll be posting it in the show notes and all of that kind of jazz. Do you guys want to explain what that survey is about?
Yeah, I can take it away on that one. Basically, just looking for any feedback from anybody who may own or maybe in the aquarium hobby field. We're just kind of hoping to gauge some of your points of, I guess, where you're getting your information is basically the key of that survey. We're still, as Colin mentioned, this is still new to us, this pathway. So we're just kind of trying to gauge what aquarium hobbyists have to say about it. And so please, if you have the opportunity to, it's really short. We're offering a Big Al's gift card or a gift card of your choice if you're the winner. Like I say, very short and just trying to gauge some where people are getting their sources.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Well, I think that's probably a good place to end it, unless you guys had anything else you wanted to touch on tonight.
No. We've gone down a few rabbit holes. It's been a pleasure, Mitch and Ian. Thanks for having us, and I appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, we went down a few catfish holes. Ian loves a good dad joke.
I love a few
bent up in there. Yeah, honestly, it was really amazing. Thank you guys for coming on to the podcast. We really support what you guys do. We really thankful that you you reached out and that we were able to make this happen. If anyone is interested, you can look them up. Invasive Species Center Ontario is usually how I find it on Google. It'll be like the first link. You guys can find it through there. They're based out of Sault Ste. Marie. Are you guys open right now for the public to come into the center or anything?
Not yet. We're starting to see more events coming back online, thank goodness. So I think this summer we'll start to find our way into more community events. Don't come find us. Hopefully we'll be able to come find you sometime soon.
Yeah, sounds good. Again, that survey I will post in the show notes. We'll also send out on our different channels. If you guys have any questions about the podcast, suggestions or anything like that, you can email us at fortherefpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach out to our different channels on Sustainable Marine Canada and For the Reef. And like every show, we want to give a shout out to our nonprofit partner, the Cayman Eco Divers over in the Cayman Islands, who's doing some amazing coral restoration work. And that is that. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the For the Reef podcast. As always, you can reach us at fortherefpodcast@gmail.com or via our websites, fortherefpodcast.com or sustainablemarinecanada.ca. If you would like to get involved and help the reef restoration efforts, check out our friends at caymanecodivers.com. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please hit subscribe and join us for the next episode coming soon.